Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us for another edition of On DoD. We're back at the Pentagon for this week's show, and we're going to spend the hour talking about science and technology, the S&T Enterprise here in the Defense Department. Our guest is Zach Lemnios, who has at least two titles here in the Pentagon. He is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, also the department's chief technologist. And, sir, it's good of you to be with us. Thanks for coming on.
Jared, I'm delighted to be here.
And I mentioned at least two. Any other titles? I've also heard you call the DoD CTO as well. Anything else on your business card we should know about?
Well, it's not on the business card, but I am called the Geek in Chief.
The Geek in Chief. Okay, good. That's good to know. Well, the timing on this interview is great because there's some pretty big news out of DoD and several other agencies that you and several other federal leaders announced at the White House recently in the area of trying to tackle the big data problem with a bunch of new funding. We'll probably spend a good portion of the hour on that. But first, I did want to talk a little bit more broadly about your office so that folks can get a sense of what you do here. And you've got a set of four imperatives that I think sum it up pretty well. Maybe you can briefly take us through some of those and maybe fold into that how the role of your office has changed in the 3 years you've been in this chair to the extent it has.
So, Jared, you're right. I did come into this position July of 2009. This is the Office of the Chief Technology Officer for the Department of Defense. And in that capacity, I have the responsibility to both shape, direct the department's science and technology portfolios to make sure that we're investing in the right set of future technologies, but also make sure that the technologies that we invest in support the warfighter's immediate needs. And when I came into the position July of 2009, did so with a clear vision to establish a set of capabilities to support the current fight. The fight at the time was in Afghanistan and Iraq. And since then have moved into areas to support future needs for the department, including our science, technology, engineering, and math efforts.
So let's shift gears and start digging into that big data issue that I mentioned a minute ago. You were part of that White House announcement that I mentioned, $200 million in commitments from DOD and four other departments and agencies to try and get after the big data problem. And first let's define the problem. As I listened to the White House event, the takeaway for me was that we as a country or we as a government have invested billions and billions of dollars in collecting and storing data, but not nearly enough in actually turning that data into something useful, or at least in extracting all the value that's there. Is that about right? Would you fill that in for me?
No, that is right. And in fact, enormous productivity in the way we collect information, the way we use these exotic sensors. You see it in your private lives. We see it in our private lives, just in the types of cameras that we buy today that have, you know, gigapixel sensors. You don't think anything of these things today. And then, of course, you go on a vacation, you come back with a few thousand pictures, and you have to sort through them.
Mm-hmm.
So the department has that challenge and more. The challenge that we have is not only understanding what's within a very large set of data that we collect, but how do we actually integrate different types of sensors? It might be radar. It might be imagery. It might be news feeds to build a picture of what's happening in a particular area.
Is it more that the types of data that you're aggregating isn't uniform, or is it the quantity of it? Is it all of the above?
Well, it is all of the above, Jared, and I use the term unstructured data. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you think about, let me stick with the example of photography.
Sure.
In that example, you know, when you take a few dozen pictures, you can lay them out in front of you. You can get a sense of what the content is. But when you collect digital imagery, we're actually sorting those images based upon metadata, based upon structures that somebody's added to the image that isn't part of the image, but it's part of the data structure. Mm-hmm. And as you think about, and as we integrate data from lots of different sensors, that format could be different sensor to sensor. So one of the challenges that we have is taking different types of data and integrating them to give a common picture, a common operating picture for our troops. And that's part of the challenge. Of course, the other one is just the enormous mass of data that we have to understand in order to find that needle in a stack of needles,
mm-hmm.
to find that needle in the haystack.
So if we're successful in solving this problem, and I'm sure it's going to be an incremental solution to this problem, what are some of the areas of biggest potential? Where might DoD harness and leverage big data to accomplish things in a different way?
Well, this has been a discussion. This has been a topic of research for many, many years. In a previous time in the federal government, I was an office director at this little agency called DARPA, mm-hmm. the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And at that time, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, we started on an effort to really build the first elements of systems that would start to understand the user, systems that would, instead of learning a user program, the computer would learn to understand the user in a very natural way. At the same time, DARPA stood up the DARPA Urban Challenge and the DARPA Challenges that really drove robotics in a remarkable direction with enormous acceleration. But the intersection of those two areas, autonomy and human-system interaction, started to come together 8 or 10 years ago. We're now at a place where the research community, in particular academia, has picked up many of these ideas, and we're starting to see the first elements of systems that will not only handle large data sets, but will interact with a user, with a human, in a very natural way. And that's what intrigued us. So about a year ago, we started having this discussion with folks in the White House and looking at what the administration could do to really push on that agenda.
The phrase that seems to go along with big data a lot of times is the idea of data to decisions. Explain that concept, and I guess it goes along with unlocking the data that we already have, right?
Absolutely right. And so it's great to have that 5,000 pictures in your photo file, but at the end of the day, you'd like to understand, what do I do with it? Do I take this collection and actually build a story out of it? Do I take this collection and try to understand that's a feature that's salient, it's sort of hidden in that large data set? The department has that challenge on many scales. So it's not just collecting information, it's processing it and understanding what the meaning of that large data collection really, really provides.
I mean, can you think of a concrete example where if we are unable to lock that data, the Defense Department performs a mission more effectively, whether it's Navy, Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, Joint?
Well, the classic mission is the intelligence surveillance reconnaissance mission, mm-hmm. where, as you well know, the ISR, the intelligence surveillance reconnaissance assets, rely upon full motion video cameras. It relies upon radar, maybe other forms of sensors. Very few of those sensors are really designed from their inception to work with other modalities. And the challenge that we have is then integrating those into a common operating picture. The manpower that it takes to do that is enormous. So when you go to an event of forward bases that integrate those data feeds, they are hundreds, if not thousands, of operators that work on large data sets, both forward-based, but also rely upon remarkable analysts in CONUS to make that in this country to make that happen in a time critical decision. So it's handling large data sets in time critical environments.
Mm-hmm. As far as how we kind of got ourselves into this problem, I mean, data quantity is obviously one thing. Did we kind of get ourselves into this problem by buying systems? And a lot of it was because of joint urgent operational needs and other operational needs that did not produce data in a way that was interoperable. Might we be able to fix a lot of this just by changing that paradigm?
Well, I think we're here because, in large part, of the success of technology development in a number of these domains. Again, the camera example. Mm-hmm. I remember buying my first digital camera maybe a dozen years ago. It was all of a megapixel imager. Today, you'd buy that as a throwaway on a cell phone. In fact, you wouldn't have a megapixel imager on your cell phone. It'd be far more than that. And each generation has increased the fidelity and the quality of those imagers to the point where today you buy gigapixel cameras that are very much on a cost curve that we can all afford. And the military has done the same thing. We have progressed to the quality of imagers and the quality of sensors to the point where the technology limiter is no longer in the front-end collection tool, the sensor. It's really in the back-end decision tool. That is, how do I take this large data set and integrate it in a time-critical way? The challenge that the department has is working on data in movement rather than data at rest. and doing this, you know, in a very rapid way with very low false alarm rates.
Explain that. What's the false alarm problem that we have right now?
So again, it's an algorithm choice. When I look at an image, building templates that help me understand different parts of that image is sort of the approach that we've taken up until a few years ago. We're now starting to look at not only templates, but what's actually changing in the image. In other words, what are the effects that are starting to present themselves in a dynamic field? And again, that puts the challenge not on the imager, but on the analysis tools, the algorithms behind the imager. And today, you know, we spend a lot of resources, a lot of man hours to go through that, building tools that automate that for us, and building tools that help the analyst understand what the salient features are, what the difficult features are in an image, and how to correlate those is really the challenge before us.
We need to take our first break here, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on big data and a whole lot of other DoD science and technology issues. Our guest is Zach Lemnios, DoD's Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. This is on DoD, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servais. This is on DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us. I'm Jared Serbu, and our guest this week is Zach Lemnios. He is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering here in the Pentagon. We started and spent most of the first segment talking about big data, and I want to stay there for probably the rest of this segment, too. Part of this White House announcement a couple weeks ago was a bunch of new solicitations that are going out from various agencies across government, you along with four other departments and agencies across the federal space. Can you talk a little bit about what is out on the street right now? I think it's there's $60 million that have been recently gone out to bid. Is that right?
Jared, that's right. We have currently, as I look across the department's portfolio, we've got roughly $250 million in efforts currently ongoing in the three areas that I call data to decision, autonomy, and human systems. And we plan another $60 million or so in solicitations in that area this year. And I'd encourage folks to take a look at a website that we've set up to describe all of this, defenseinnovationmarketplace.mil. It's all one word. Provides insight for industry, for academia, for others to take a look at where we're headed. I'd make one point here, and that is that while the announcement by the administration covered the broad area of big data, it was a big announcement on big data, mm-hmm. we actually, you know, I look at this as an opportunity to integrate three disciplines that for the department, I think will be a big deal. It's the disciplines of course, data to decision we talked about, autonomy, that is taking these large data sets and helping to build autonomous systems that can interact with the environment in time-critical ways. So think about moving from a tethered robotic system to an autonomous robotic system with little human interaction. And the third area, of course, is human systems, and that is building systems that can interact with humans in very natural ways. All of that has to be done in a wrapper of trust. That is, we've got to have trust in these systems, and these systems need to understand in their coordinates when they can make a decision, when they can't, and when they need to call in a human. So it sounds very much like science fiction, but it's we are really at a place where academia has built the foundation for a lot of this. And we're starting to find elements of it presenting themselves even in the private sector.
You anticipated my next question, which was about data trust. I mean, that's, as you point out, incredibly important for automated systems, autonomous systems especially. But what are the challenges there? What are the gaps between the current state and where we want to get to?
So, again, think of a tethered robot where some operator is operating using a joystick to maneuver that system in and around obstacles. And now fast forward a little bit and imagine a system that understands the environment, understands when it doesn't understand the environment, it has to call home for help, understands when it can make a decision, when it can't, and can path plan and can sort of project where it's going to go. The Navy a few years ago started down that path. and in fact made some significant investments in undersea autonomous systems that are now starting to deploy, and we've seen them in the news. That's a pathfinder for us in many, many areas. I'd like to see that same type of system used across a department, where systems interoperate with humans in very natural ways as peers, and can call upon an operator for assistance, can provide an operator with insight that the operator wouldn't have otherwise. And again, we're within really a few years of being able to do this.
Mm-hmm. The Navy was nice enough to invite me and a bunch of other reporters down to their new autonomous systems laboratory at NRL a couple weeks ago, and I saw a couple of these things in action. One was a drone literally flying around the room with no human interaction whatsoever, just completely on its own. A couple firefighting robots that just interact fairly naturally, as far as I could tell, with human beings. Is that really where we're headed?
That's exactly it. Now, think about that drone operating in an environment that it's never operated in before.
Right.
So the one you saw probably had some training, probably had some constraints on it placed for that in that venue. Imagine a drone being placed into an environment that it's never operated in before and with very little training can come up to human performance standards. Or one that, in fact, improves its skills as a good pilot improves his or her skills over time. Similar things. And then being able to call back to an operator to provide assistance and provide guidance.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've alluded to this, but as far as the big data issue, DOD is not striking out on its own on this. Talk about the state of the multi-agency, or as people say, whole-of-government approach to this, and why it's important to coordinate our efforts. Well, first, are we coordinating our efforts? I assume the answer is yes.
Well, we're coordinating them in two ways. First of all, across the department, they're absolutely coordinated. They come through our office, and I'm looking at not only where the money goes, but also where the ideas are. And so that's a big part of our office, is to make sure that we've got a solid technical story and a solid performer base for what we're trying to accomplish. But the other place where this is coordinated across government is in the performer side. So when I visit universities, when I visit small businesses and larger companies, we see the level of understanding of this field has really increased over the past several years. I mentioned the DARPA Urban Challenge as one sort of catalyst in this. There are others. I think everyone has, not to put a plug in, but everybody has an iPhone Siri. Well, that program actually started as a DARPA effort 8 years ago.
Oh, is that right?
It was a program that that we had to build a tool that would allow a conference to collect proceedings of that particular conference in very natural language. That is a tool that would understand what was going on, build the inferences, build not only the literal meaning of what was being said, but also all the inferences behind what was being said, and most importantly, improve its performance over time. And we had a set of benchmarks in place to do that. The company that did that work for us, Science Research Incorporated, SRI, Menlo Park, they did a remarkable job in collaboration with other universities and other performers to take that concept and actually build a product that now everybody carries. And now think of that product operating in different environments with very little training data and integrated with most of the other types of sensors that that the department operates. That's the vision that we're trying to get to.
Mm. Take one more break here, and we will move on from big data and talk about some of the Defense Department's other strategic priorities under the science and technology area. We are talking with the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, Zach Lemnios, here at the Pentagon today on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbail. We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. We're talking science and technology this week with the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, Zach Lemnios. We spent the first half of the show pretty much talking about big data, several new solicitations that have just gone out to industry to try to solve that challenge. You can find some links to a lot of information about those on our website, federalnewsradio.com. I want to shift here, though, and talk about budget. It's difficult to talk about anything in the Defense Department right now without talking about budget, and that certainly impacted science and technology to some degree, I'm sure. And other DOD folks, Mr. Lemnios, including the comptroller, have said personnel programs were largely protected in the new strategic guidance, understandably so. at the expense of some of the modernization that, that might have happened absent the Budget Control Act. So what's that mean for science and technology? Your budget request, I know, has gone down slightly from what was appropriated for this year. So what trade-offs have we made? What's risen to the top of the priority list? What's fallen off, maybe?
So, Jared, the Budget Control Act has, has very much put everything in a place where we've got to compete on our ideas and on the value of those ideas into the department's missions. 3 years ago, we started down this path. 2 years ago, we started down this path by outlining a set of science and technology priorities to shape the department's investments, not only to support the immediate needs of the warfighter, but also to make sure that we're invested in the right technical areas over the next 5 years and beyond. We did that by looking at the Quadrennial Defense Review, looking at the missions that the department was going to be operating in and supporting, and building a technical story for what are those areas that really are going to make a difference, and we've got to make sure that we're invested properly. And out of that came a set of science and technology priorities that Secretary Gates at the time signed off. It was about a year ago, and those included seven areas that that we regarded as the key areas for the department. And those are, I'll just list them very quickly.
Sure.
Those are cyber operations, electronic warfare, data to decisions, which mm-hmm. ties to the discussion we just had. Autonomy, which ties to the discussion we just had. Human systems, again, countering weapons of mass destruction, and engineered resilient systems. Looking across the department, our spend, or the amount that we've requested in the FY13 budget for those activities is part of our full budget request of just short of $12 billion in FY13 as it's part of the President's budget request. And within that $12 billion, there's about $2 billion in basic research. The other parts, applied research and advanced development, compose the balance of that effort. But those S&T priorities really are the core ones that we're making sure that we have the right ideas, that we're connected with a solid set of performers, that we have emerging concepts that are being developed across industry and academia, and that we're able to couple those efforts into the department's needs.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned two areas, electronic warfare and cyber, which brought to my memory a hearing a couple weeks ago, maybe February, where the deputy director of DARPA was saying that we're now at a point where roughly 90% of an electronic warfare system can be built with components that are commercially available that anyone can get their hands on pretty cheaply. How do you innovate in an environment like that, and what challenges does that pose for the department?
Well, I was part of that hearing, and that absolutely is a challenge, and it moves us from the hardware side of the problem to the software side of the problem.
Mm.
So if you look at these systems that are built today, your iPad's a great example. You do amazing things on this little tablet, not because you change out the hardware, but because somebody's written an app for it.
Mm-hmm.
That you have innovation occurring at all levels because people know how to write apps for that piece of hardware. So the challenge is making sure the hardware is right, having a developer community that actually can program onto that platform, and from the department's perspective, making sure that all of that can be done in a trusted and secure environment. And that's really the challenge that we're after, and we're working this across a supplier base, this trusted and assured supplier base that allows us to build not only software-defined radios, but other systems that intersect hardware and software in some very unique ways.
Mm-hmm. And not just doing that in trusted environments, but I imagine one of the challenges has to be acquiring those in a speed that's somewhat commensurate to the pace of innovation that's happening outside. Is your office part of trying to? I mean, because that's a separate innovation, right? Figuring out how to do acquisition.
So early stage innovation and transitioning early stage innovation to a warfighter's hands is something that we have learned and have worked over the past several years supporting the warfighter, supporting efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. We work directly with units forward, and we are supporting them transitioning concepts on days and weeks, not years and decades. So we're taking those lessons learned and applying them To future systems that we're building and we'll be acquiring through the department.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that hearing you were a part of a couple of weeks ago. One of the things you said, if I remember correctly, was that one of the things that you've done is moved some of the functions that your office used to do here in OSD and push them out to the services. That's kind of an organizational chart issue, but I think it's still interesting. Explain some of the reasoning behind that.
So, Jared, it's important. That was an important transition for us. We've moved many of the projects that were run out of my office. We still see those efforts internally, maybe spend a little bit of time teeing them up within the Pentagon. But eventually they have to be executed by the services. They mm-hmm. have to be implemented by the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the services that actually build those capabilities, work with a developer, so that those concepts are embedded in our service community. There are a few that we still retain within the office, within the Office of Secretary of Defense, within my office, where the efforts are so cross-cutting and the technology is not quite mature enough that there's a tech base installed. Engineered resilient systems is in that category. It's an area where we're trying to build new models for systems engineering. We're building that construct. We're working with performers, and once that's in place, then we'll eventually transition that to the services for eventual implementation.
Mm-hmm. Back to the budget. I mean, even though $12 billion is a big number, it's nowhere close to what industry and academia spend on science and technology research. You want to talk us through how you decide where to focus your slice of the overall R&D spend that we have as a country so that you're not duplicating other people's work and you're zeroing in on things that are really going to be important to DOD?
Well, and that's, Jared, that's the challenge that I have every day. I mean,
yeah.
It's making sure that not only is the spend correct, but the quality of the spend and the initiatives that we're supporting are ones that are critical for the department. To give you a calibration, industry does spend far more than this annually, but most of the industry work, and we've looked at this, is really centered on concepts that are quite mature. The department reimburses industry about $4 billion a year for their internal research and development efforts. That's $4 billion a year of spend that the department provides. And as I looked at the quality of that, the content of that spend, these are mostly efforts that are quite mature, that are within a year or 18 months of an acquisition program. So they're almost ready. They're not quite, but almost shrink-wrapped, ready to go. The efforts that we have are far less mature. They are ones where we are working with academia. They're ones where we're working with small business community and early developers to develop a first concept and establish the fundamental underpinning for a technical area. They're also ones that have to transition to an acquisition program. So the spend that we have isn't sort of pie-in-the-sky blue efforts. They really do have to transition to efforts either to industry or to our acquisition programs directly to support our acquisition efforts. And so there's a difference of scale, but there's also a difference of risk level that we take, vice industry is taking in their investments.
Meaning your risk is much higher or their risk is much higher?
No, in many cases we will take the higher risk position in order to make sure that we've got a preeminent position in a new technical area. The announcement in big data is a great example, right? So this is a push that the administration's making. It's a push that we're making to move from a research concept to an application space. And hopefully we'll get industry to pick up on this, spend a little bit of their IRAD in this area. And by doing so, we can shape our investments accordingly.
I may be confused, but I think you said a second ago that a lot of that research spend you do, A, it's high risk, but B, it also has to transition into an acquisition program.
Right.
Connect those two things for me, because if they're high risk, there's a good chance that a lot of them aren't going to succeed, and they'll never be ready for an acquisition program, right?
Well, some of the early research efforts, in fact, are horse races that we put in place to see what are the end technical ideas that will find their way to an acquisition program.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, those will take some time to mature. But at the end of those events, the concept that is the most mature is going to have to be inserted into, you know, really find its end space into an acquisition effort.
Gotcha. Okay. The bottom line is there are things that – it's not like these are programs where we're saying we have no idea if this is going to work or not. There are things that have a definite end point.
They have an end point, or they have a it may be an application concept that some program manager says, look, if this works, it's going to be a big deal. You know, if the Siri program, you know, in the mind of the program manager a dozen years ago, that program was a concept that would in fact have a big impact, and today we see that impact.
That gives us a good transition for when we come back. I want to talk about improving interactions with industry, both in small, medium, and large businesses, all areas that I know you're working on. We'll come back with Zach Lemnios, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering here in DOD, on DOD, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu, and we've got one more segment with Zach Lemnios, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. As we close out the show here, I want to dig a little more into a topic we just started getting into in the last segment, which is interactions with industry. That's a good transition to another thing you've launched and which you briefly mentioned, which is the Defense Innovation Marketplace. And I gather the idea is to get at least big vendors to input a large, a high-level view anyway of their R&D projects into this database so you know what they're working on. Is that basically right?
Jared, I think there are two things. First is we want to find ways to bring to light those ideas that industry has that could really accelerate the development of the areas that we're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's large or small business, whether it's academia, we want to capture those ideas in a way that we can pounce on them and start driving those concepts. The other thing is we wanted to have a way to share with industry and academia, the performer base, what the government's doing, what the Department of Defense is doing in these technical areas. So, you know, if you're a small business in the area of data analytics, here's one way that you could immediately see the department's interest in that particular area. So we launched earlier this year this website I mentioned earlier, defenseinnovationmarketplace.mil, one word, as a way to capture all of that. There are three areas on that website. There's an area that ties to government users so that the government users can look at internal research and development efforts that have been submitted by the performer base. There's a place for industry to submit that under a password-protected portal. And then there's a place for industry to look across the department as to what our science and technology solicitations and priority areas are.
Mm-hmm. You've worked, I think, in both government and industry. From your perspective, has this been a huge problem in the past where both sides are guessing as to what the other cares about and or is working on?
I've been on both sides, and I've seen the guesswork, and I've seen places where it works and places where it really hadn't in the past. And this is one way for us to try to be very clear about where we're going with it. We're transparent with all the solicitations, but this is a way to try to make those connections much more transparent, much easier for somebody that has an idea to come into the department and try to connect that idea with the challenges that the department presents.
Mm-hmm. Unless I'm mistaken, the visibility you're getting into R&D through the marketplaces is mostly geared to large firms. So much innovation comes out of small businesses, though. What are you doing lately to make sure you have visibility into their capabilities and that those get integrated into DOD programs?
Well, the large firms, in fact, submit their IRAD, Internal Research and Development Plans, and results into this marketplace website, and that helps us. It helps them. But the other thing on that, the other portal on that website allows anybody from industry to take a look at what the department's needs are, where we plan to do business with the private sector, what are the technical challenges that we're after. We've posted our roadmaps. We've posted technical roadmaps in each of the S&T priority areas that I mentioned. So again, if you're a large or a small company that's doing work in human systems, you can take a look at how we've structured that technical area. What are the challenges that we're trying to address? and how do we see that those plans emerging over the next several years. It really does give industry and academia, large and small industry, a way to look at the department's planning process, at least technology planning process, and structure their plans accordingly.
Mm-hmm. A lot of those small businesses I mentioned are doing innovative things and yet have not or hadn't up until recently done business with the Defense Department. Talk about some of the successes that you've had there that you're seeing.
Well, we've seen many, and whether it's to be flexible using our contracting authorities, whether we contract using other transaction authorities or other mechanisms, there's plenty of flexibility to make sure that that's not a barrier, to reduce that barrier of entry. At the end of the day, it really is about the ideas that industry and academia have and how those ideas connect with the department. Mm-hmm. And those are the connections we're trying to build with this website.
Mm-hmm. In the time we have left, I want to talk about STEM education, which I know is something that you care about. First of all, how is this a DOD issue? You obviously need a future workforce, but is DOD the best place to run these kinds of programs, vice DOE, vice any of the hundreds of other STEM programs that there are across the government? How does that all work together?
Well, it is a DOD challenge. It's a challenge for every one of us. As a parent, as a leader in the department, the future workforce of the department is as critical as the issues that we deal with day to day to support the needs of the warfighter as we see them each day. So making sure that we've got an absolutely world-class workforce is critical. From my perspective, as the department's chief technology officer, I want to make sure that not only do we have a capable and deep workforce, but we have one that's educated and that's absolutely front and center on the technical issues, the technical areas that we see emerging over the next decade. Think back 20 years ago, the term data analytics just wasn't in our vocabulary. Mm-hmm. The term cyber was just starting to emerge. The terms of electronic warfare, autonomy, data to decision, that entire discussion, none of that was the topic of the day 20 years ago. Today, that's a center point. And so making sure that we have students that understand those underpinnings, that can operate in those environments, and that are bringing ideas to the table, whether it's within the department or within the defense industrial base or academia bringing those ideas forward, that's the enterprise that we're trying to strengthen. And it's not going to happen by coincidence. It really does take mentorship. It takes a concerted effort to make investments in students and leaders in each of these areas over a broad base across the administration that's happening, and certainly across the department that's happening in our office.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how long DOD's been directly involved in STEM education programs, but are we far enough along yet to know what works, to know what specific activities when the department engages in them get kids excited and make them want to come work here or at least become more educated about STEM?
So, Jared, I've seen a host of competing concepts. They all build. There's no one example that works, just as there's no one teaching approach that works for all students.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from science fairs to challenge problems to site visits to school visits, they're all part of that enterprise. I actually am doing a visit to one of the local high schools later this week to talk to high school juniors and seniors about their future and the future opportunities they might have. We're doing a science fair, a national science fair on the Mall later this month or next month. And so I actually spend a fair amount of time on this. It's one of those topics that we can't just turn on and off. We've got to be on game all the time for these students.
Right. In the 2 minutes or so we have left, I want to talk a little bit about your current workforce, and in particular the cyber workforce, which everybody's talking about right now. I mean, what the big challenge everybody talks about is compensation. It seems to me DOD's never going to be up to par with what industry can offer. I mean, what are the other big challenges, and are there things DOD can do to overcome that compensation differential?
Jared, I don't think the compensation issue is first order the challenge that we face. I mean, it's a pragmatic piece of it, but I think the biggest challenge that we face, you mentioned it and I mentioned it, and that is the speed of acquiring new concepts and the speed of innovation. In my coordinates, making sure that this country is absolutely first. First at the head of the pack in the concepts that we're developing in cyber and the other S&T areas is absolutely critical. But equally critical is the time that it takes to, in fact, transition those technical ideas into an operational capability. And those have to occur in months, not years. And they have to occur at the pace that we see in the private sector on the commercial devices that we all use every day.
Mr. Lemnios, it's been a terrific hour. Thanks for bringing us up to speed on DoD science and technology. Really appreciate you doing this.
Jared, glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Zach Lemnios is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering here in DoD. Tune in next week. We'll have more on DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Visit us at federalnewsradio.com to read more and to listen to this or any of our past shows. I'm Jared Serva. See you later.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serva. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.